broadcasting in HD radio at 88.9 FM. This is Central Coast Public Radio, KUSP Santa Cruz, and KBDH San Ardo, streaming live and podcasting at KUSP.org. Hey everybody, I'm Gary Shapiro, and it's time for From the Bookshelf. David Haidu is my guest this week. His latest book, The 10-Cent Plague, deals with the McCarthy-era Senate hearings into those corruptors of America's youth, the comic book. And like all this author's work, it's a fascinating book. David Haidu, welcome to From the Bookshelf.
Well, thanks for having me on, Gary.
Now, before we get to The 10-Cent Plague, I must quiz you about your last book. Your last two books were both about music. Lush Life, the biography of Billy Strayhorn, which was published about how many years ago now?
Oh, you're going to make me look old. No, 1996. Long enough now that Richard Price could steal the title and get away with it.
How about that?
1996.
And then there was Positively Fourth Street, which was a biography of Joan and Mimi Baez, Mimi Farina, and Richard Farina, and a guy named Bob Dylan, and that came out in 2001, I believe.
That's correct. I'm very grateful for the way you describe that book, because you describe the idea of the book was to do a book about two sisters who were competitors and their men. So it's really a book about the Baez sisters and for Richard Farina and Bob Dylan. So I'm very grateful for that. Didn't you write the Dylan book? Or tell me about your Dylan. And it's not a Dylan book, Dylan.
Well, you know, I'll tell you, the strangest thing happened to me when I was reading that book. Just as I finished it, the moment that I finished it, I turned on the radio and heard that Mimi Farina had died.
Yeah, it happened just around the same time.
It was very strange.
It was awfully... You want to hear something even stranger? I don't think I've ever said this publicly before. Partly because, if you haven't read the book, my describing the following will reveal the tragic climax of the book, but I think enough time has passed. If you read the book, you know the climactic events are take place during Mimi Baez Farina's 21st birthday, and you know Mimi is married to Richard Farina, who's a very controlling figure, and here is the day of her. Her literal and legal emancipation, her 21st birthday, and he died on that day.
Yeah.
And you know, if I had written that in a work of fiction,
an editor would say,
"Oh, you know, that's ridiculous. Things don't happen that neatly." Okay, Richard Farina was born on my birthday. This is purely coincidence. I'm not a freak on numerology, but he happened to be born on my birthday. He died on his wife's birthday. His wife, Mimi Baez Farina, and she died on my wife's birthday.
Well, that is just weird, isn't it?
Yeah, it's meaningless, but
still slightly
but eerie,
weird.
But eerie, yeah, very, very eerie, yeah.
And that was a wonderful book, Positively
Fourth
Street. I enjoyed it very much. And I also found it interesting that since the publication of that book, and of course there are, I think, approximately 28,000 books about Bob Dylan, that Bob Dylan himself wrote a book called Chronicles Volume 1, and he does not discuss, really, the era that you cover in your book. It's kind of the part of the book that he skipped over.
Well, he skips over much of his life, and it's not a chronological book. And remember, it is Volume 1.
Right.
And,
volume 3, I'm sure, is coming.
To do 3 volumes.
Yeah.
I trust that he will. He wrote that with such enthusiasm, and it's such... vigorous and startling, from my point of view, startlingly lucid and cogent account. But I have every confidence that he intends to do the other two. So, you know, because it's not chronological, he may intend to end with that period, or who knows what he intends to do. And that, you know, also, Bob Dylan has always taken the path less traveled. The element of he wants is always sought to say, do something new, say something new. And the period of the 60s is one that has been written, much has been written about that period, much has been written about work, his work in that period, I think largely because that's the period when he had the largest cultural impact. whether or not he did his greatest work, he certainly did his most important work if you measure importance by cultural influence during that period. I have a fondness for, you know, his work from many other periods. So he may have just thought, well, that's already the subject of 28,000 books. Why should I add one more to the bookshelf? I mean, my intention with that book was to never just add another one to the thousands already done, but to do a book not about these figures, but not really about these figures, about these people, about their time as much as about their lives, and to do the lives with a big capital S in the end, to make it for the book to be, I wanted the book to be a study of the influence of lives on each other, and the effect that creative people have on each other's lives and work. I wanted to deal with different kinds of relationships, both competitive relationships, collaborative relationships, romantic relationships, and sibling relationships. And in the end, what I hope to, I wouldn't say provide some answers to, but probe a bunch of questions about the ingredients of success in creative lives in this culture. Well, why do some people success both aesthetically and in terms of their careers, and why some people don't? So that's why I thought it was interesting to do those four lives. I love talking about this book, and we don't have to talk about the 10-cent plague at all.
Well, I love Positively Forest Street a lot. It was a wonderful book. And I want to ask you if you had feedback. Now, I'm assuming that Bob Dylan did not contribute anything to your research. Maybe I'm wrong.
Well, at the time, Bob Dylan had not even signed to do Chronicles yet. And the evidence of his previous interviews suggested that had I interviewed him for the book, I might not have gotten much.
Right.
So he surprised us all with this evidence to the contrary, this, you know, wonderful book, Chronicles.
And, of course, Chronicles came along at the same time as the film, with
right.
No Direction Home, which is also very lucid and talkative.
I didn't at the time consider it a great liability to have not gotten an interview with Dylan. He never turned me down. He always said through his company, I'd be happy to do it when I have the time. And then he never found the time. And I did, I'm not sure if you know this, Gary, I did arrange to have access to the original research materials of Robert Shelton, who was Dylan's first biographer.
And, right.
And Shelton did extensive interviews with Dylan from his very first days in New York, through the period at which my book ends. That does not really write syntactically, but up to the point when my book ends and past that point, that's what I meant to say. These are in-depth contemporary interviews, the interviews of the time where he's interviewing Bob and Dylan is saying, I wrote a new song last night called, you know, Mr. Tambourine Man, let me tell you about it. So those interviews were really invaluable because Dylan is less filtered and he's less on program than he would become later. So Shelton has died some time ago, and I arranged through his estate and through the Experience Music Project before it was even open to use Shelton's original research materials. So through those materials, I had access to a wealth of interviews with Dylan that I thought surpassed what I would have even gotten with them had I interviewed him at the time I was doing the book.
Since he probably doesn't remember it as well now.
Oh, yeah, what did you say here?
I say since he probably doesn't remember it as well now.
His accounts of events at the time were much different from the accounts he would give later of these events, and they were much freer, and Shelton didn't even use much of that material. Shelton was a very significant figure, but it was a little loosey-goosey on some matters of ethics as a historian and as a journalist. He was doing reviews of Dylan and other artists, and also doing publicity services and writing liner notes and sending out press releases under assumed names. And he kind of got mixed up about what his role was as a biographer, and he thought, I think he came to think that his chief role was a booster of Dylan, not as a, you know, as a critical historian, cultural historian, or biographer. He didn't use some of the best material, and so most of the quotes in my book never didn't appear in that book that hadn't appeared before, and they came from that archive. So, I should add that Dylan eventually did read the book because.
Oh, that's what I was going to ask you next.
Yeah,
what did you get feedback?
I needed his permission to quote song lyrics, permission from his publisher, which is his company, and. His manager, Jeff Rosen, who's a good guy, said, well, Bob wants to read the book. And so Dylan took it on the road with him, and I didn't hear back for months. So meanwhile, the book is in galleys. There are review copies out, and I'm biting fingers, nails, and toenails now waiting to hear back from Dylan. And finally I heard back from Jeff Rosen. Okay, Bob said you could quote, he read the book, he said you could quote the lyrics, but you have to pay $100.
Well, that seems reasonable.
Well, it's like free. I mean, for all those lyrics, I quoted a lot of lyrics. So that was a compliment. And now, looking back, I'm not sure if that's good or bad. I'm not sure if the subject of a book is supposed to like it or not.
Well, I was going to ask you about Joan Baez, because now the book is not reverential. It's not rude, but it's a pretty honest portrayal of these four people. And two of them are still alive. So what about Joan Baez?
Well... So Joan read it, and so did Dylan, and so did Mimi before she died. Neither Mimi nor Joan were fully happy with the book. They didn't think that it was factually inaccurate in any way. It was a matter of, I think, the fact that I portrayed them, and I thought, in their the full complexity of their characters. And, you know, since this book came out, I've now been on the other side of the fence, and some people have written about me, and I have to say, I don't like it very much. You know, and I think the more complex the portrait, and the truer the, you know, we're human beings, we're all flawed, and I mean, the truer the portrait, the more it reveals all of our dimensions, and none of us likes that. We don't want to be portrayed, we want to be flattered. I certainly do. You know, I don't want to be captured accurately, you know, I want to be captured flatteringly. So I can't hold it against anybody else for wanting to feel the same way. Well, my goal, though, in that book, all three of my books is to neither glamorize or glorify or damn anybody. It's never to elevate anyone or put them down, but to seek the truth and portray people on a fence in all in their full complexity. And the model I have in my mind is I try to think, well, what if I were writing about my brother? You know, now my brother. You know, if I were my brother and I, you know, we're brothers, so we have some problems with each other, but we all ultimately we love each other deeply, and we love each other, you know, not just in spite but because of our differences. So I try to think, well, I want the portrayal to be true, but loving. So anyway, that's what I try to do.
We're talking with David Hadou, and we were just discussing his previous book, Positively Fourth Street, which is a marvelous book you should all go out and get. And so two books about music, and I know your wife is a musician, Karen Oberlin, and you are a record reviewer, a music critic, and now you've written a book about comic books. So what led you to write about the 10-Cent Plague?
Well, I've been writing about comics for a while now, in addition to writing about music. I've done quite a few pieces on graphic novels and comics for mostly literary-ish places like Book Forum, the Times Book Review, and the New York Review of Books. I've done half a dozen pieces for the New York Review of Books, a bunch on this subject. So, you know, I've been I've been exploring it and writing about it for a while now.
Were you
Were
you a comic book reader as a kid?
I was. I'm of a certain age. What am I now? I'm a little over 50. So everybody my age, well, not everybody, but you know, a great many people my age read comics. But I didn't write about comics mainly because I'm a fan. I wrote about them. I'd rather write about something I don't know about than something I really know about, or something I'm curious about than something I know. I don't just follow my passions. That's another way. The passions is important, but intellectual curiosity is equally important. And also the sense of the kind of commitment to try to say something worth saying. Because I have passions for a lot of things that just aren't that worth writing about. You know, passion. I love pie, for instance. I don't know how much there is to say about pie. So
it's round.
It's round. It's good, but yeah. You know, after that, I know now somebody's gonna take me to task and write a great book about pie. I just feel like a fool.
The Life of Pie was a big book a few years ago.
Pardon me?
The Life of Pie was a very big book a few years ago.
Now I'm gonna have to go back and read it.
That's a different pie.
Yeah, I know.
But let's talk a little bit about comics. Mm-hmm. And the story that you tell. Mm-hmm. And, of course, in your book, I say of course, but people don't know this, in your book you don't just talk about this brief period in American history, but you give us the history of the medium of comics in mm-hmm. pretty good depth. But it came to this time in the 1950s when the blacklisting happened and the McCarthy era was in full swing, and the comic book hearings fit right into that, would you say?
Oh, yeah, absolutely. The hysteria over comics was related and of a piece with the overall hysteria of the post-war period, and that's really the main subject of the book. If you look at the title, it's The 10-Cent Plague, The Great Comic Book Scare, and How It Changed America. A comic book is a modifier there. The noun is scare. So the book is about the hysteria over comics and the battle over comics, and then their consequence, their effect, their impact on the culture, how it changed America. So on those terms, I think the book has a lot in common with my first two books, so which are, you know, both kind of cultural inquiries, and the positively Forestry really is about the maturation of post-war American music. And this book is, I think, a companion to that, in that it's about the birth of the post-war sensibility, but I place it in a world, in a sphere of in a time, in a world that's very different from rock and roll, in a time before the rise of rock and roll. So so I think they're related, and they're both inquiries into the kind of backwards. The first book is about the maturation of post-war popular culture, and the first book is about the birth of post-war popular culture. So they go hand in hand. But the hysteria, you know, the country basically went crazy over comics in the late 40s and 50s. There were in California, the county of Los Angeles passed legislation in the 1940s, making crime comics illegal, making it illegal to sell crime comics on the newsstand. We have about 50 pieces of legislation around the country at the same period, and then there were community actions against comics. There were church groups, organized parishioners, and protests against comics. Kids took part in bonfires, ritual bonfires, in which comics were burned all over the country for a period of 10 years, and then there was state legislation, and finally Senate hearings on the event. There were a parallel to the Hollywood 10 hearings, the HUAC hearings into the communist influence in broadcasting and television that, you know, that we think of as the
The blacklist.
We associate with McCarthy, but really McCarthy had nothing. You know, was a tangential figure in the HUAC hearings.
Right, but you know, let me just ask you this. And we're speaking, by the way, with David Hajdu, and his book is called "The 10-Cent Plague," and it's all about the scare over comic books. Now, the reaction to rock and roll that occurred, you know, around the same time, I think, was largely kind of racially based, a fear of the intermingling of the races, I think, to a good extent. And that is ridiculous. And the fear of communism turned out to be rather ridiculous also. But in the comic books, and although to us nowadays we look at those comics and see them as pretty harmless, in that violence in our culture has gotten so much worse in the 50 years since this scare took place. Was there maybe, and I don't think you draw a judgment in your book, but I'm asking you now, do you think that maybe there was some valid argument to be made that these comics were just simply too violent and seeing these violent images is not good for children?
Well, first, let me take the first part of that and talk about what biases were at work in the anti-comics crusade, because I think you very wisely isolated the race bias against rock and roll and the fear of corruption by a foreign political system and economic system it boiled down to McCarthy, what we think of as McCarthyism or the Red Scare. I think there was a class bias at work in the fear of comic books, because comics were considered a lower class form of expression, because they were visual and they were vulgar and they were made by immigrants. And also, I think there was a generational bias. I think above all, more than anything, there was a fear of on the part of the pre-war generation, the adults during this period in the late 1940s, of that this genre is made by young people for young people. It represented a sensibility that challenged the sensibility of older people, and that somehow that would end up representing kind of a cultural takeover, takeover a new sense of. I'm not saying that very well, but I hope you get the idea.
Yeah, you're saying in the same way that the fear of rock and roll was that the African American race would take over America, this was a fear that the lower classes would take over the literacy of America.
That's correct. Thank you very much. You should write a book about this subject. The lower classes and also young people.
Well, it was that youth explosion that came, you know, 10 years later, I guess, is hinted at here.
But the question is a very valid one of was there a point here, and was there a kind of extremism in these comics that was a valid cause for concern on the part of parents or protectors of youth? And I think the answer is really very, very complex, and that's why there's I devoted 400-plus pages to it. So, shorthand, let me say, mostly no. Is that the question was, is it valid? Mostly no, because I think that these comics were an outlet for kids. I think that they're an escape hatch, they're an escape valve, and they were a way for kids to confront issues of good and bad and confront evil and deal with these issues. I think that they were elementally designed to shake up and challenge and defy older people and their sensibility, and they succeeded in doing that. I think that was their function, and they succeeded. But all that said, was there also cause for alarm in the extremism in some of these comics? I think yes. I mean, I'm a parent of three myself. The two kids are older, but I have a boy who turns 5 in a few days, and I would not want him to see the comic called Fear, or some of the comics that were published in the late 40s and 50s were unspeakably violent and gruesome, and also and that portrayed violence as a with a kind of glee and a sense of play, and that were even more troubling in their time than they would be to me as a parent today, because they had they were unlike anything else that was available to kids in those days.
Since there were no video games or violent movies and so forth.
Right, right. I think this is not a simple matter. I tried in the book to portray both points of view, but I tried to not even portray it just in the black and white, you know, the two-sided way. I tried to portray these issues in a more dimensional way and also put them in historical context. And that's why, as you pointed out, I start the book with the turn of the last century. And I show that the precursors to comics, the newspaper comic strips of the early part of the last century, incited the same kind of controversy that comic books later did in the 40s and 50s. So, it's hard to do justice to it in half an hour now, and I tried over 6 years to come to terms with the subject and do justice to it in hundreds of pages. But I'm not trying to dodge the question. I'm just saying it really is complicated.
You did a very good job of dodging the question. The book is called...
Well, hold on. I have to keep... You know, I don't want to discourage people from buying the book either.
It's a fantastic book, and I'm going to encourage them to buy it right now. It's called The 10-Cent Plague, The Great Comic Book Scare, and How It Changed America. David Haydu is the author. And David, before you go, tell us, what are you going to do next? What's your next?
I'm writing a biography again, back to music, a biography of Billy Eckstine, a wonderful and important jazz singer who had a tragic life.
And a marvelous voice.
So look for that in, I don't know, however long it takes me, 5 years, maybe 10.
Well, I hope you'll come back to From the Bookshelf before then, because obviously we have lots to talk about.
Oh, thank you very much. I'd like to.
That's all the time we have for this week's From the Bookshelf. Hope you enjoyed the show. I'll be back with another program next week at the same time. In the meantime, check out our podcast page at KUSP.org. Thanks, as ever, go out to our From the Bookshelf staff, Miss Breanne Beal, for all of her hard work. Thanks, Breanne. For KUSP, I'm Gary Shapiro. Thanks for listening.